I need you to think about this and just answer it subjectively and answer it honestly, okay? Like, first impression. Do you have enough? First impression. Do you have enough? You have too much. Too much. All right. You mean you've got too many things stored under the bed? Is that what you mean? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Who has enough? You have enough troubles? I like the way that twisted mind works. Yeah. You have enough in life? How many feel like you don't have enough? How many are worried? One person? Yeah, you're all liars. Because the stats show that anxiety about having enough in America is through the roof. It's skyrocketing. And all sorts of anxiety, afflictions, and diseases had its historic highs in America. Blue water is special because we're all perfect, so it doesn't affect us. I know. Just a couple of us. That question, do you have enough, is appropriate here, but I feel like it's appropriate in the world right now, very generally. I feel like it should be a provocative question. Do you have enough? Or maybe we could phrase it, do you have enough for today? And is having enough for today enough? Because that's usually what it boils down to, right? We're doing this sermon series out of the book of Exodus. Everybody knows the story of Exodus. The story of Exodus is about the Israelites getting out of slavery in Egypt. There are all sorts of miracles and plagues and stuff involved. The parting of the Red Sea. Then they end up navigating through the wilderness, miracle after miracle, on their way to the Promised Land. It's a story about God freeing the Israelites and taking them to the Promised Land. It's a bit of a tragic story because they don't actually make it into the Promised Land. That first generation didn't anyway. They sort of chickened out in the final instance because they discovered there were some giants in the land. Remember that phrase? And so they refused to cross the Jordan River. The next generation finally did after the Lord taught them to fight a little bit. So when we started this sermon series, we started at the end, actually. We looked at what it takes to be free, truly. Because the story of Exodus isn't just about taking people out of slavery. It's about taking slavery out of people. Right? And that's really what this sermon series is about. How does the Lord make that rarest of all creatures on earth, the actual free individual? Very, very few of those on planet Earth. And it takes a lot of doing to create them. And this is the story about how God makes humans out of humans, how he makes us fully human, you know, fully free, because that's his intent for us. And he's making a people here, but he's making his kind of people. He's making people who are alive. And when you start at the end, you realize that at some point you're going to need the ability to not chicken out. You're going to need the ability to go beast mode. That's the phrase that we use. You're going to have to go beast mode at some point in life to kind of launch into the orbit that God would have for you. And then the following week we talked about what it takes to defeat the gray in life, because most of us are not enslaved by darkness. We're enslaved by gray. We are comfortable living halfway. We are comfortable with being oppressed. We are comfortable with being controlled. The Israelites had gotten fairly comfortable being controlled by Pharaoh. They had 400 years of slavery. They developed a slave culture, a culture that wanted to be controlled. And one of the first things that God does in the story is actually he makes their lives doubly uncomfortable. And that was the first step on the path to freedom. You know, when God gets a hold of the life, one of the first things he often does is he creates a lot of crisis in that life, to make you very uncomfortable so that you have to move, right? So that was the first thing we talked about. Then we talked about the temptation of reasonable compromises, because that's what Pharaoh did to the Israelites. He offered them a bunch of reasonable compromises. God had instructed them to ask for a worship retreat. Let us leave Egypt for a while. We're going to go into the wilderness. We're going to worship God. That's all we want. We want some time off. And Pharaoh said, no, you don't get to go. No vacation for you. And then he offered them a bunch of compromise solutions. How about a staycation? How about just the men go? How about the families go, but you leave all of your herds behind so that I can trust you to not run away, and so on and so forth. And the reason he was offering compromises is because God was sending plagues to Egypt. God was progressively shaking the system. And that happens a lot as we grow up in life. God progressively shakes the system. Shakes the system around us. And you have to be willing to let that happen and not make compromises just to keep the peace, right? Peace is sometimes the enemy of freedom. And indeed, we talked about the moment of deliverance, and the next week, the Israelites, after the 10th plague, after the Passover, and all of that beauty, beautiful symbolism, and savage repercussion. It was a savage miracle, the 10th plague. The Israelites finally get free, and on the way out, they plunder the Egyptians. They ask their neighbors for their treasures and stuff like that. And in effect, they made enemies of the Egyptians. They made enemies of their former slave owners, and they walked into freedom with a bit of swagger, with a bit of attitude. So we talked about having the attitude of freedom, the attitude of deliverance. You have to be willing to swagger a little bit. Everybody swagger in your seats on the count of three. One, two, three. Some of you have a swagger that looks like a hen laying on an egg. I just work on that a little bit. Anyway, last week we started a section of the sermon series. We were talking about controllers in life, other things that control you, because God doesn't just want to free you from Pharaoh, doesn't just want to free you from an oppressive situation, wants to free you from things that control your soul, shall we say. And so last week we talked about how God freed the Israelites, not just from danger, but from fear, which is a different thing than danger, right? Even when the danger ends, the fear can linger in life. And a lot of us, very few of us are controlled by dangers, but a lot of us are controlled by fears. And that's really the story of the parting of the Red Sea, where God made the Israelites face the Egyptian army. They were trapped against the sea in a dead end. And God was like saying, well, I already freed you from the Egyptians. Does the fear still haunt you? Do you not think that I can do it again and again? So that was that story. And today, instead of being free from the tyranny of fear, we're going to talk about getting free from the tyranny of need. Getting free of the tyranny of need. Because need is something that haunts us and controls us a lot. Need, like fear, and like pretty much all other emotions, left on its own can be a bit of a tyrant. Need is an instinct that drives you to get what you need. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like hunger is an instinct that drives you to get food. There's nothing wrong with that. But a lot of people have problems controlling their hunger, and they miseat or they overeat, right? You have to master that, or it masters you. Well, the instinct for need works the same exact way. You know, we need things, so we get things that we need, but you have to master need, otherwise it just gets voracious. You know, it starts overeating, in a sense, and it takes over. And the instinct for need, the feeling of need, will take over a life. It will be a huge tyrant, a huge controller, much like fear might be. And so God won't have that. And so he sets out to teach people about freedom from need, how to develop in them the ability to walk free from need. Now, we all have need in life. I asked you about, you know, a few minutes ago, do you have enough in your life? And most of you probably thought about material things and maybe about how God is a provider, and that's why most of you good Christian people said, oh yes, I have enough, because that's good Christian training. You know. But hopefully you also have some stories of provision in your life that really help you. I have tons. I grew up in some material need and some extreme circumstances, so I grew up kind of knowing what it was like to just get by, or to go from day to day, or to have miracles of provision. And then as I continue through life, I see that God continues to work that in me, like maybe some of you. I graduated from college with some student debt. Anybody? Anybody? It gets worse and worse every year, the burden of debt that students have to carry to get through college, which is interesting. And when I graduated college, I went to grad school. I got a free grad school. I got full ride scholarships for grad school. But then grad school ended, and I still had all the leftover student debt from my undergrad years. And I didn't really have a job apparent for me at that point. My academic career had sort of fizzled. And so this is how I paid my student debt. And some of you may remember this story. I've shared it in years past in sermons. A friend gave me a stock tip. And so Sony and I took all the money we had in the world, and we bought this stock. Kitty, hey, you remember. It was the stock of an emerging company, and it was the company that produced this thing called Pokemon. Right, so this was the stock tip. It's like, this is really popular in Asia. It's coming to the U.S. You should invest in this company. So we did. Actually, it was about 2000. And so overnight, we earned tens of thousands of dollars when the stock broke in the U.S. and paid off all my student debt. Amen. Snaps to God. Yes. That's how I paid off my student debt. Now, you know, it took some risk and stuff like that. But, you know, people of faith, you learn to take risks. So I was feeling pretty good. It's like, all right, well, this is how God is going to provide for us, right? You laugh, ye of little faith. Ye of little faith. Life has been hard, you know, but the Lord always provides. And look, He has provided richly. He's provided abundantly. I have tens of thousands of dollars in my bank account. Paid off all my students. I wrote the check right away and sent it off. Just completely wiped out my debt. We were debt free. And I love to sail. And so my landlord had a cool sailboat, and he was sailing from Boston to Bermuda. We lived in Boston at the time. And so I'm going to go on a sailing trip. The stock was still, our stock holdings were still live on the market. I hadn't liquidated it all. I said, honey, watch the stock. She watched it absolutely tank. What I meant was watch the stock, and if it starts going down, sell it off. She missed that second part. Anyway, it was complicated. And this was back in E-Trade days and stuff like that. Yeah, it's like, well, the button wouldn't work, dear. Anyway, so when I got back from the sailing trip, and it was a wonderful sailing trip. When I got back, we had $0 in the bank account. So that's the story of God canceling my student debt. The debt went away. So did all the extra. And 10 days after paying off my student debt, I was back to zero. And that basically has been our lives since then. The Lord provides, but I never have gotten much above even. You know, maybe some of you can relate. In our current situation, like, you know, we get paid just huge amounts of money to pastor this church. We have two kids in college currently. And they... you know, we've been blessed. They both got lots of scholarships and stuff. So, like, it's not costing us but a tiny fraction of what it would normally. But it is an expense, and travel expenses and stuff like that for them. We have a side hustle to kind of make ends meet. We have a house, and we're Airbnb-ing a portion of the house out and stuff like that. We're okay. We're also teetering on financial ruin right now because... I started this boat construction company with a business partner, and I've shared that story. He betrayed me, and so we lost everything, and there are lawsuits and stuff like that. So we're like kind of okay making it. Might go bankrupt in a week. Making it, that's kind of where we are. That's kind of where we live. Do I have enough? Do I have need? Right on that edge, right on that edge between making it today and losing everything tomorrow. Right on the edge of like tens of thousands of dollars are going to pay off all our debts to like, oh, nothing. I guess I can't buy my own sailboat. That's just kind of life. Need is an instinct that drives us to get what we need. But how does need respond to just this sort of normal situation that I'm in? How does it diagnose the situation? How does it diagnose no debt, no savings? How does it diagnose demands, college, mortgage, opportunity, loss? Need is not that smart. It doesn't know when to stop. And that's what the story is about today. This is the famous story, begins in Exodus chapter 16, of God providing manna in the wilderness for the Israelites to eat. The Israelites have left Egypt. They've been traveling for about 2 months now. The first crisis that they get into after crossing the Red Sea is that they don't have enough water to drink. They come to some springs. The water has gone bad. It's toxic. It's happened a lot in desert springs. They get bacteria in it. So Moses throws a stick in the water and it turns sweet, which is to say it became potable. It became drinkable. The Israelites drank, and then they're hanging out at a really cool oasis for a while where there are some fresh springs. And then they come up with the second grumble in Exodus 16. And I'll read segments of the chapter. You can follow along on the big board or on your own phone app, or if you have a hardcore Bible like a real Christian, you can read along with that. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim, this is kind of the nice watery place, and came to the desert of Sin, which is a great name, but it doesn't mean what you think it means. It's like Sin's the same root as like Sinai. The desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they'd come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve the entire assembly to death." These guys could grumble. They were hardcore complainers. I mean, you have to respect talent like that. They've already seen, at this point, at least 12 major miracles that got into their deliverance. And they get out in the desert, and they're hungry. They don't have the sort of food that they're used to. So they decide collectively that Moses is actually a mass murderer. And that the whole thing has been concocted for Moses to get them into the wilderness and let them die an inglorious death by starvation. That's the accusation. They go straight to, this isn't going well. Let's accuse the leaders of wrongdoing, which has been a human instinct from time immemorial. So the Lord responds to them. You know, they're acting poorly, right? If anybody would have cause for faith, you would think the Israelites did, because they had seen the hand of the Lord expressed mightily in any number of ways at this point, right? Any number of ways. You'd think they would say something like, "Well, we're hungry. I wonder what God's going to do. Hey, Moses, what do you have up your sleeve?" That would have been a reasonable conversation. That is not the conversation they have. Why? Well, because they're used to thinking like slaves. Probably they're used to being abused or oppressed or being defensive or something like that. They're certainly not used to being people of faith and freedom. So Moses and his brother Aaron and the Lord, they kind of huddle together, and Aaron stands up in front of everybody. He's the better speaker and says, "Look, the Lord is going to provide for you." And picking it up at verse 10, while Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. Now, that would have been interesting. Aaron stands up and says, "Look, God's going to take care of you. Don't kill us." It's basically the address. And then behind him is this great special effect. The glory of the Lord appears in a cloud. I don't know what that looked like, but evidently it was discernible. Like the people had physical evidence that the Lord was with them, which you'd think would just be awesome. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. then you will know that I am the Lord your God. That evening, quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" And the Hebrew word for "what is it" basically is the word manna. Manna. And so they called it, "What's this?" That's how it got its name. You didn't know that?
No.
There's a lovely pigeon quality to that, isn't it? I like it. They said, "What is this?" And Moses said to them, "Well, it's the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer, which is about 3 pounds, for each person you have in your tent." And the Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some gathered little, meaning like, well, some overestimated what 3 pounds was, some slightly underestimated what 3 pounds was. But when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much didn't have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little, even. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, "No one is to keep any of it until morning." See, there are rules that come with this. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses, and they kept part of it until morning. But it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. And so were their wives. I might be projecting. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed. And when the sun grew hot, it melted away. So it only lasts for a while. You had to go out and harvest. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much. 2 omers for each person. And the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, "Well, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning." So they saved it until morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. This is a cool story of the Lord providing miraculous bread in the desert, and it's also the first time that the Lord discusses the Sabbath with the Israelites. This is how that dialogue gets started. He gave them a rule. Look, you can only gather as much as you need for the day, but on the sixth day you can gather double, because on the seventh day it will last. If you gathered it too much on Wednesday, it's going to rot by the next morning. But if you gather a lot on the eve of the Sabbath, then it's going to last. So there's a little sub-miracle within the miracle, as it turns out. So lots of rules and amounts that go with this. You like this story?
Yeah.
The whole manna story is a really huge deal in the development of the Israelites. They would eat manna for, it turned out, 40 straight years with all sorts of creative recipes. It's like zucchini. But this is basically how they survived in the desert of Sinai, which would have been probably like the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. There is nothing out there, right? So this was truly miraculous food, and it kept them going and their herds going and like everything else. And God even commanded them to take some, put it in a jar, and stick it in the Ark of the Covenant at a certain point so that this would become a reminder for every subsequent generation. Manna was a huge deal, absolutely fundamental to their development. So hard to overstate that. And obviously what's going on here is that God is teaching them that God provides, right? That they don't have to worry, that God provides. And God can always provide. God can provide out of nothing. God can provide miraculously. But what's fascinating to me about the story is all the details and the rules and the process that goes along with this. You can only gather about an omer, you know, like one of those omer cups that you have in your kitchens. Omer. I don't know. You can't read that word without thinking about The Simpsons. Am I right? Omer? Nope. And you can only gather it in the morning. You have to go out and get it fresh every morning. On the sixth day, you can gather double. If you gather too much, it goes rotten. And then there's this whole idea of the Sabbath that the Lord throws in there, which is a really interesting detail as well. So clearly the story isn't just about provision. right? The Lord has engineered this, has detailed it in a way that makes one suspect, there's a way of provision that God is trying to get across. And if I put it that way, then what would you say? I mean, what's the way of provision that God is trying to get across? What are phrases that pop into your mind? Dependence. Now, which is interesting. Like, other people have said that as well. The Lord is freeing slaves. Would he teach a slave dependence to get free? Don't be smart. Yeah, so I'm, because that's a word that I come to as well. So, well, he's probably not teaching them dependence because that's very slavish. Trust is an interesting word, which is an interesting toggle, right? Is he teaching them dependence or is he teaching them trust? Which word matches to freedom? Trust matches to freedom. Yeah, and a lot of Christians read this story and say, I'm just going to depend on God. I'm just going to depend on God. But remember that God actually wants you to be independent too, in a way, right? He wants you to trust him. And so you see that his provision often has an ingredient of trust building in it. Are you following along? It's subtle, right? It's good development psychology, you might say. God is, I think, trying to teach them trust. Phrases that might pop into your mind as you read this story, if you're a veteran Christian and Bible student, would be something like, oh, I don't know, daily bread. Anybody ever heard that phrase before? Yep. Right? The most oft-quoted piece of scripture in all the world, in all of history, is the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread, right? Which means, like, just give us enough for today, or give us, you know, enough for one day. It would be a more literal translation. So there's a pattern of provision here, which really, really bugs me, to be honest about it. God is just taking these guys out of slavery. And if God wanted to show himself a provider, a trustworthy provider, why not give them huge amounts? Why not make them rich? Because wasn't that show that he's a great provider? Why just give them a little bit at a time? Because they can't handle it? They might not trust him every day if they don't need to, something like that. Yeah, I think there's something to that. Let me ask the question a different way, though. Let me ask the question a different way. If you're just getting by in life, do you feel really free?
No.
Oh, that's an easy question to ask. Right? How many of you feel like, I'm just getting by in life? Oh, I feel so free. I feel so free. But the Lord has engineered this miracle such that they're just getting by. Right? So there's something about daily trust, you know? It's like, well, I have to trust him today as well. And we recognize that as being valuable. I mean, if you have to look to God every day, all else equal, that's a fairly helpful habit. But in terms of like trusting God for provision, a lifestyle of getting by, does that really help you? Does that really help you see God as a trustworthy provider? Somebody pointed out in my Ohana group on Wednesday that, you know, there's value in repetition. And if God only gives you enough for today, then in a given year, you have 365 independent exercises of provision. You know, 365 examples. How many of you have one great story of God providing for you out of nothing? How many of you have hundreds of stories of God providing you out of nothing? And repetition is habituating, right? And so if you've had one time in which God has provided for you, praise God. If you have 800 times that God has provided for you, you are probably a uniquely stress-free person. It's gotten into you. So there's something like that going on. But just to cut to the chase, I think the main thing has to do with this Sabbath connection in the story. And I would express it as the difference between leisure and rest. Or bounty and rest, maybe you want to think of it. God is trying to get across to the Israelite what to the Israelites what it really takes to get free from need. Leisure is having much, but rest is having trust. I think that's the moral of the story. Having much and trusting God are two very different things. And clearly, as we've already discussed, God is providing for the Israelites here in a way that develops their trust, right? Trust is the only thing that sets you free from need. Having much does not tame the need instinct. Having trust does tame the need instinct. You following me? See the difference? Poke the person next to you and say, "Do you understand?" And then you can judge. You can judge for yourself whether they're following. If you have a lot of money, it may feel good, but you probably don't see your money as kind-hearted. You probably don't see it as a generous provider. You probably see it as something that you have to tend. And, you know, there are such things as stressful millionaires, and you may know some. There might even be some here. I don't know. There's always more to do, even if you have a lot of money. Even if you have a lot of money, there's always more to do. But if you have God, it's different. And this is what God's trying to get across. It's like, look, I'm your God and you're my people. You have me in your life. And that means that you don't have to hustle endlessly. There's not always more that you have to do. And what I love about the system of manna provision that God sets up, and he's going to drill this in dozens of different ways over the course of the years, and Jesus, of course, is going to pick up the topic in his day. He's creating a system wherein there's only so much you can do to get ahead. You know, like if you gather 30 omers of manna on Wednesday, it's going to go rotten by Thursday, right? You can't get ahead, which is exactly how the Lord has structured my life. It's like, oh, here's tens of thousands of dollars. Go on a vacation. Oh, you're broke. That's kind of my life. You know, is that a blessing for the Lord?
It is.
Oh, easy for you to say. There's only so much that you can do to get ahead. And therefore, if you're going to rest on Sunday or whenever, you're going to have to do it through trust. You're not going to be able to do it through much, through leisure. You understand?
Yeah.
And so the Lord is like drilling his people on this. It's like, I'm not going to give you too much because I want you to learn how to rest in trust. And so this provision comes with the Sabbath commandment. We haven't even gotten to the Ten Commandments yet. The Sabbath is actually the first one, instituted before the Ten Commandments even came. It's like, this is a lesson about rest, people. It's not a lesson about provision. It's a lesson about rest. It's because rest frees you from stress and striving and slavery. And so he's going to provide for you in a way that makes you rest out of trust. You get it? Everybody following? Yeah? Some of you are sleeping, so you've understood the lesson on rest on Sunday. So That's not true. No, they're not. Sony said some of you are shopping on Amazon right now. I have a million stories of provision. I've got so many crazy stories of God providing for me. You want to swap money stories, I will trade you story for weeks on end. But I never get much above even my whole life. So if I'm going to rest, I have to rest out of trust. This is the drill that the Lord has me on in life. It's like Tevye says in Fiddler on the Roof, money is a curse, but may God bless me with it. Yeah. No, may God curse me with it is the line, right? May God curse me with it. So I feel like, yeah, you know, the Lord has really worked trust into my life. Dang it. But it makes me a person of trust, and it makes me a person of rest, and it makes me a person, not of leisure, but it's made me a person of creativity. And we talked about that last week, the value of creativity. And I think it's made me freer in a way. It's given me a sort of courage that helps me walk through life in a manner, well, I don't get snagged on the material stuff. You know, I'm able to be generous in a way that is probably uncommon on the earth. And I think that, you know, Blue Water has excelled at that as a community. And our generosity has fueled a lot of life change. And what I can do today is, well, I can pray for you to have more money if you want. Jesus says, you have not because you ask not. He teaches on this all the time, doesn't he? You know that Jesus teaches more frequently on money than any other moral issue in the Gospels? You know? Consider the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor store in barns, but your heavenly Father feeds them. They're free. They're free. They don't have to work that hard, you know. You have to work a little bit. What I love about the manna story is that there is a daily chore that they have to do, right? They weren't allowed to skip a day, except for one. You know, they had to get up and they had to harvest and they had to figure stuff out and they needed to do the math and stuff like that. It's a story about the combination of reasonable workload and trust. Reasonable workload and trust. I make that point because humans are apt to make one of two errors when it comes to workload in life. They're going to work too much, they're going to be workaholic, or they're going to be lazy. They're going to be lazy. And both those things are going to skew their relationship with trust, right, and provision. So, you know, there's more to that story and it will develop. But what the Lord is saying is like rest brings freedom from the tyranny of need, and rest requires trust in this world. I can offer you trust today. I can do that. I can offer you trust. And I can tell you as well that the Lord might instill trust in you today, perhaps give you a gift of faith to get started. It is the nature of trust that you will have to exercise it over time like a muscle. You might have to exercise it, daily, right? Which is why Jesus taught us to pray as he did, give us today our daily bread. But, you know, maybe, if not daily, you might have to exercise it from month to month. You might have to go through life with the attitude that God will provide for me. I just don't necessarily get to choose how. You know, that's been my experience. The Lord has always provided. But man, has he been creative. And I've had to flex. I've had to do a lot of pivots in life. If you get the hang of it, it's actually kind of fun. I say, in faith. He will develop trust in you. I think this is an important life skill these days because very few people work for the same company for 40 years anymore. We have to reinvent life all the time. And if you're young, you've probably already gotten the hang of this. Right? The technologies that dominate your life are going to be different in 5 years' time than the technologies that dominate life now. I think that Christians have a great advantage in today's world because we just trust the Lord will provide. And we just get up every day, we do some reasonable amount of work, and we see how it's going to work out. That's the proper attitude of trust. And then we work rest into our lives. We don't sweat it. There's one day in which we just don't have to sweat it. One day every week. And I encourage you to honor the Sabbath. Honor the Sabbath because it makes you free, right? It makes you free. I read a great study recently. It was conducted by the Harvard Business School, actually. And it was about the value of degrees from Ivy League universities. Did you guys read this study? It was kind of front page for a while. So they did a big study about they compared like students who went to Harvard, Princeton, Yale to a group of students that applied to Harvard and Princeton and Yale but got rejected and went to state schools instead. And it turned out, over the span of about 25 years, the Ivy Leaguers out-earned the ones who were rejected by 3 cents on the dollar. Yeah, the value of an Ivy League education comparatively is zero. I love that. I just absolutely love that. You know, instead of getting $20 an hour, you're going to get paid $20.60 an hour because you went to Princeton. But they have different sorts of jobs, but they earn the same as people who went to state school. And the reason I love that story and I think about it today is because, like, kids kill themselves to get into Ivy League schools, right? And they think that it's going to set them up for life. Brothers and sisters, nothing is going to set you up for the rest of your life. Nothing. Absolutely nothing will set you up for the rest of your life. And maybe some of you have experienced the insecurity of having your life disrupted over the past few years of shutdown, or maybe, you know, previously in life, and it bothers you and it makes you feel haunting need. Well, get over it. Be free. Don't be a slave to that. Nothing is going to set you up for the rest of your life. But you can trust God. And that's the only way to navigate life. He's not going to set you up for the rest of your life, but he's not going to leave you alone for the rest of your life. He's going to be with you constantly. It's going to be an adventure. You're going to be walking through the desert of sin, and you're going to find provision out of nowhere. That's the promise. That's the promise. So if you are willing to set aside the lie that something can set you up for the rest of your life, then God is willing to give you trust and rest that will empower you for the rest of your life. You up for the trade?
Yep.
Are you up for it?
Yep.
All right, that's the deal. Father God, I pray that you would honor this trade in us. It is a trade. It is the most fundamental financial transaction we'll ever make. Nothing is going to set us up for the rest of our lives. Shoot. We might not even set up for the year. But we can be free. And we can be powerful. Would you rather be the sort of person with the funds to live in a luxury condo, or the sort of person who could walk into the desert and find provision even there? That's the trade. Holy Spirit, just deal with us where we are, with our material, our financial anxieties, our job anxieties, our worries about providing for our family, our worries about career, about education. Whatever it is, we lay it before you now. I'm just going to give you 60 seconds to deal with the Holy Spirit on that.